welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I am joined for this special little episode by Mr. David Holmes. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Ollie. How are you doing? You well?
I'm very well, mate. I'm very well. We're recording this on Thursday, right before the Easter bank holiday, aren't we? And we're gearing up for the weekend, basically. But we were meant to be off this week. We were meant to be off this week. Obviously, because it's a bank holiday and we normally record these live. But there's been quite a bit in the news, and we realised that we won't be doing a GDPR radio for another couple of weeks. So we thought we'd just record a little bonus one-off episode, didn't we?
Well, I think you've probably been rather too polite. I think it's because I started moaning off about a couple of things, and you thought we'd probably best do one because it just gets it off my chest. But yes, we thought we'd jump on and do a quick one anyway, just to keep the listeners, give the listeners something to take on over the Easter break.
Yeah,
I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, so a bit different, as I say, it's just the two of us, and obviously we are recording this introduction before we get stuck into the main body of it. Before we get into that, the usual intro bits. So we are, as I say, taking a week off this week from the live sessions, but the live sessions come back next week, 22nd of April, with our big ISO 27001 event, where we'll be joined by Stuart Barker. You will have seen a lot of promotion for that already, and we're going to continue to promote it because we're really excited about it. I think it's going to be a smashing event. Really looking forward to that. Stuart's a very charismatic chap, and it's going to be a really, really good session. Other than that, there's plenty more events to come, as you will know. So head to the events page on the DPP website to sign up and find out more. And before we get stuck into the main body of session, before we let you get stuck into that, I do have a request for you. As you will know, listener, if you're a regular, I've developed a bit of a tendency of, at this point, begging for reviews, in all honesty. But if you are not able to leave them on any of the streaming platforms, then why not head over to Trustpilot? We've just set up our account on there. It's linked into the DPP website. That would be really useful. We've already got some fabulous reviews from regular listeners who like to tune in. Just to give us a bit of feedback, and we really appreciate those who have already submitted a review. And if you enjoy these, we'd really appreciate it if you could submit one too. Any other feedback, sure. Get in touch with us, info@dataprotectionpeople.com, LinkedIn, all the regular bits. Get in touch, let us know what we can improve, what you like, what you don't like, and any suggestions for future topics. I'm going to leave it there, Dave, before I run out of breath. Anything to add to that?
I was just going to add a very shameless plug that if you are going to leave a message on for us on Trustpilot, just to kindly drop my name in there somewhere and send the elements of the podcast that you like that I come out with, that would be great.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to do that, Dave. I was going to be a bit more I was going to be a bit more subtle about it. But yeah, name droppers, why not? It would be greatly appreciated. So without further ado, I'm going to leave a little break here so that producer Mars can edit in the rest of the rest of the theme tune, and we'll see you very shortly for the main episode. Right then, Dave. So really, we're just doing news this week, aren't we? There's one more theoretical question that I'd like to ask you because I came across it this morning, but we'll get to that shortly. There's been a few bits in the news. I'd like to start, if I may, just quickly, because I don't think there's actually too much to be said about it, but I'd like to start, if that's all right, by just picking up on the ICO's announcement this morning that they will not be taking any further action in relation to the Matt Hancock CCTV business. So just to jog everyone's memories, we did speak about this at the time when it first happened, but I'm sure we'll all remember back in, I think it was July of last year, some CCTV footage was leaked by someone of former, I think he was health secretary at the time, wasn't he, Dave? Former health secretary Matt Hancock basically having an affair on camera. Someone recorded the CCTV, leaked it to the press, etc. In the wake of that, the ICO orchestrated a raid on someone's home. But now they're saying after, so it was July, we're now in April, they're saying that they haven't got any evidence to bring any type of action or prosecution. Any thoughts on that, Dave?
Was it any evidence or any substantial evidence? I can't remember which way it was.
Well, their exact statement, sorry, I've got it here. Their exact statement is they're saying they found insufficient evidence. So they don't talk about the quality of the evidence. It doesn't seem to be an issue whether they've got anything substantive. They're just saying they haven't got enough evidence.
My initial thoughts on that would be if there was insufficient evidence or not enough evidence, then really what evidence was there to go and raid somebody's home?
It's a very good point. It's a very good point. Generally, you don't launch an investigation unless there's enough evidence in the first place to launch said investigation. So,
precisely, I mean, that's kind of the angle I'm coming from. There must have been sufficient information available to warrant the intrusive nature of raiding somebody's home to try and find evidence to pin on them. You would have thought they would, to actually go through all of that and kind of go, well, we didn't really find anything. Which,
I mean, to be fair, I'm being a touch flippant about it, which obviously there's a difference between the standard of evidence that you'd need to actually conduct an investigation and the standard of evidence that you'd need to bring a charge against someone, bring a case. But I don't know. I mean, we're not privy to what's happened, but it's just another slightly meek response, isn't it? I mean, to be honest, I'm not that invested in this because it doesn't seem like a big deal to me. I know that's, again, a bit insensitive because obviously he had a family and children who were all affected by this, and it's not the sort of thing you want happening. No,
to be fair, it's also a bit of a fine line, isn't it? Because you do get that argument. I know everybody's entitled to privacy, and we've seen the old privacy cases with things like Naomi Campbell and the Campbell case against was it MGM Newspapers or something like that, I think it was. Although that was a bit more sensitive than this because of issues surrounding the case, that kind of thing. But there is that fine line between freedom of the press and being able to hold people to account. Not just people, but parliament, government to account, that kind of thing. And secondly, individuals, when they take on such roles, and it must be within their reasonable contemplation that they're probably going to get an unwarranted amount of public interest in what they're doing, or at least press interest in what they're doing, especially if they're forming parliament and not just kind of backbenchers and that kind of thing. Now, I'm not kind of saying just because you're a public image or you're a public person and that kind of thing, you've waived all rights to privacy. In that sense, but it does lead you to kind of tread that fine line between, well, how do you hold people to account if you're going to stifle the press and you're going to stifle freedom of investigation and that kind of thing? How, in essence, not trying to make it a kind of a political thing, but you look at the way some countries around the world, and for example, Russia, because there's a lot of that in the news at the moment, look at the way Russia produces news to Russians in Russia and that kind of thing, and how they limit the information and limit the knowledge that's available to hold them to account in that kind of sense. And I think we've got to draw a very fine line. I think it's an absolute right that we've got the freedom of press. I think it's an absolute right to hold people to account. And how do you hold people to account if information is stifled overly too much? But I know it's a fine line with privacy to draw.
No, and I think, but that's a reasonable point, right? Like it's the inherent tension between, say, Article 8 of the Human Rights Act, right to private life, and Article 10, right to freedom of thought association, and that envelops freedom of expression and therefore the press. I might be getting that wrong, but Article 8 is definitely right. I don't know about Article 10. Anyway, but yeah, no, you're right, because ultimately there is potentially a public interest in this. And as you always say, what is in the public's interest isn't necessarily in the interest of the public, or vice versa. How do you say it?
It's more or less what you said. What is in the public interest? I can't even say myself now. I've got my tongue tied. What is of interest to the public is not necessarily what is in the public's interest.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think that this is, again, the sort of thing where the lines start to blur when you're talking about government, right? Because ultimately it is difficult, because is it fundamentally in the public interest to expose a government minister having an affair? Not necessarily. Does that context change if it's in the midst of COVID and people are meant to be social distancing? Possibly. I don't know. What do you reckon?
I'm a little bit more, well, you know me, I tend to have a very wide cynical streak as opposed to a very narrow cynical streak. And I've got a very wide cynical streak. One, I think, is it really in the public interest? Well, I'm really not sure if it's really in the public interest. He's entitled to a private life. People have relationships. Relationships break down. People have affairs. I'm not saying it's right. And there's obviously harm and impact on individuals involved. But he's no different to anybody else out there that's kind of been through that kind of process. So therefore, is it in the public interest? I'm not sure. And the cynical part of me is kind of coming through saying it's probably more in the interest of people in political parties that aren't aligned to the party that the individual comes from. So it's more in the favour of, for example, Labour trying to pull him apart and say this is what Matt Hancock particularly like, because it would favour them, because they're having a dig at the Conservatives. And likewise, you see, and I'm not trying to do any political affiliations here, it's just that's what's in power, and that's it could be seen that way. But you see it all the time where politics, somebody in power says something, or somebody in one of the political parties says something, and the automatic response from every other political party is to pull it apart. What I'd actually find more refreshing is for politics to actually agree with each other from time to time, going, actually, you raise a very valid point. Why do we have a cross-party agreement, or put across party some kind of focus on addressing this matter instead of necessarily pulling each other apart? So I think it's probably more trying to bring it back to the point in the interest of party politics, shall we say, as opposed to necessarily in the interest of the public.
Yeah. I mean, well, again, that's the tension, right? Is it in the interest of the public, or is it broadly in the interest in the grand sense of us as a nation? Yeah, I mean, listen, we're at risk here of veering into a topic and a conversation which is not really for us to say, but I do think it's worth reinforcing that it all seems a little bit meek to say that there's not insufficient evidence to do anything. And the problem is, even if that's true, it continues to build this image of a regulator without teeth, right? Which is problematic.
Well, for sure. I still stick by the fact that if there's insufficient evidence to warrant any kind of action on the back of that, I'm surprised whether there's sufficient warrant evidence to warrant the intrusive nature of raiding somebody's home. That's got a big privacy impact. Whether Matt Hancock should have done what he should have done or shouldn't have done and all the rest of it, to actually raid somebody's home, to kind of crawl through the property to try and find evidence. And let's be fair, once it's hit the press and it got the press focus that it did, I'm sure whatever you did, you'd be trying to hide your tracks pretty quickly. I'm sure you're not going to be sat there with a file on your desktop and that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? The people who have been doing this surely are very clever people and surely have thought about the implications of what this means. So do you honestly think, even if you had sufficient evidence to knock on somebody's door, they would actually be where you're looking? You know what I mean? In that kind of sense. And it's all that element. Yes, I get the bit about whether the regulators, and we had a discussion, so we said on the last podcast about the improvements that we hope John will bring. And if John's listening, I'm trying to be a little bit more gentler on you this week in that sense, and the benefits that they may bring. But yes, it does kind of sit with me in that point, really.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. Well, I'll tell you what, in terms of, so we've got two segues here potentially. We've got one which is relating to individuals' right to private life, I guess, in a broad sense, or at least not interfering in due process, shall we say, and another which is to do with, okay, I actually can't think of a segue for that one anymore, but I'm going to go with that one because it's slightly more upbeat. Do you want to tell us about this speeding reporting app?
Yeah, just before going on to that, just because we mentioned the Human Rights Act, I don't know if you caught it in The Guardian, was it this week? Yeah, I think it was this week, a couple of days ago. There was an article about replacing the Human Rights Act. I know we've spoken about it previously, and there's kind of open for consultation in bits and pieces. The government's trying to kind of go, we don't want the Human Rights Act, we want a Bill of Rights or something or other, that kind of thing. There was an article in the Guardian that basically says there's a joint committee on human rights said that the plans contravene the principle that human rights are universal. And it's kind of got a bit of a slating in the paper, as we all aware. Obviously, if it does change, it may have an impact on the way we look at the impact of personal data breaches, the impact of how we process personal data when you're looking at the how individuals may be affected and things like that. But Harriet Harman, who was the chair, said that the government's case of human rights legislation was in serious need of reform was not proven. There is nothing in the consultation that would serve to strengthen the protections we currently have and much that would weaken them. And I was just thought it was quite interesting because it's a bit of a, like I said, it's not necessarily a tenuous link to what we're just discussing when you're looking at the human rights elements of it. But it's interesting that it's still kind of about and
well,
in that sense with the proposed Bill of Rights.
Well, that is very interesting. And again, just a quick tangent, particularly because there's not too much to say on this. And as per usual, we're at risk of veering into the sociopolitical rather than strictly privacy and security. But just an aparté on that, what this highlights every week is that we're never just talking about data, right? It's always bigger than that. It does always touch on politics and social matters.
Well, I think it will, and I think the two are really it's difficult to extract one from the other, because when you're talking about personal data, we're talking about how we protect personal data, how we should comply with making sure that the regulations are there. A lot of it is then looking at risk-based. When we're looking at risk, we're looking at the impacts on the individuals and the abilities of individuals, or whether what we're doing will have an impact on the individual's ability to exercise their rights. And it's not necessarily just their rights within data protection laws, but the wider rights, and your rights to freedom of discrimination, freedom from intrusion and stuff. So it naturally brings in elements of human rights law.
Yeah, 100%. And just on that note, before we move on, I think it's worth mentioning, because we spoke last week about Project Sunshine, and it's probably just worth touching on the fact that this week, very recently, possibly today, or at least this week, the government has announced this scheme that it's going to have to send people crossing the channel in boats, migrants, refugees. I'm not going to get into the politics, the terminology around it, but clearly there's something kind of relevant in that. But they're going to be sending all of those people back. Well, that's the thing. It's not back. They're going to be sending them to Rwanda. So they're going to put in place this massive scheme where if you are a migrant who has crossed the channel in one of these boats, they're always going on about the government and making a big deal about reclaim our borders, etc. They're going to ship them all to Rwanda, whether they are from Rwanda or not. And I believe what they're going to be doing is instigating a pilot scheme where the Rwandan government will be looking to settle them in their country. Now, I don't want to comment on this too much to get myself in any trouble, but when you look at that, you look at Project Sunshine. The reason I bring it up is as a segue from your point about watering down the Human Rights Act, right? Watering down legislation which guarantees rights to people on British soil and British citizens, it all leaves a bit of a bad taste, in my opinion. I don't think that's a controversial thing to say.
No, I don't think it does. I mean, you've got people who are in serious need of assistance. You know what I mean? The fleeing persecution in their own countries. At the end of the day, most people just want to have freedom to enjoy the family life, to be able to care for the kids and make sure that they're free from any kind of harm and violence and that kind of stuff. So you can absolutely get the need, and they're just wanting to go to a better place in order to achieve that. And why would that necessarily be wrong? And if you try to empathise with them and things, you can certainly, looking at the individuals at the moment kind of fleeing from Ukraine and stuff, you really do feel for them. You know what I mean? And it's why should we close borders? Should we not be doing more and that kind of stuff? I do get the point that, and I'm not necessarily agree with shipping them to Rwanda, because that's, in essence, if you're not careful, not too many steps away from, if we don't want people, we'll ship them halfway around the world like we did with criminals many, many years ago, that kind of thing. And I'm not saying it's right, but there is, how do you stop people making high profits out of people trafficking and the dangerous conditions of crossing the English Channel in small boats where many lives are lost? So I do get the need that they've got to do something.
It's a reasonable point, but
yeah. I'm not suggesting this is the answer.
No, because then you're at risk of basically addressing the symptom rather than the root cause, right? Like and putting the onus and the emphasis on that. And also, and again, without wanting to go into detail too much on this, and I'm going to segue away from it in just a second, but it is probably worth noting that when you read the coverage on the BBC website, and you mentioned what is happening in Ukraine at the minute, which is simply appalling, but if you read the news coverage, those fleeing the conflict in Ukraine rarely have the words asylum seeker, migrant or refugee associated with them. They're certainly not in any threat of being shipped to Rwanda. So
just to clarify that point, I wasn't suggesting that we're going to be shipping Ukrainians there.
I know you weren't. I was just drawing a parallel.
It's just looking at more the displacement of people who had actually, it's the displacement of people who are forcibly removed from their homes through a needless conflict.
No, exactly. And this is my point, is that, you know, this it's one rule for some and one rule for others. Anyway, before we get ourselves into trouble, Dave, let's move swiftly on, because
I'm starting to fill out the depth.
Let's move on to I actually can't do that segue. I was about to come with an absolutely appalling segue. This is the problem, we haven't got an audience, it's a bit loose. I tell you what,
first,
let me
it's the first time I'm keeping my eye on the chat.
Yeah, the first and last time by the sounds of it. let's move on to something a bit more lighthearted, but there aren't many lighthearted topics this week, Dave. Let's talk about this speeding up, which I think is what I originally asked you about, and you seem to ignore my prompt. You were talking about the Human Rights Act all of a sudden, so I don't know quite what happened there, but do you want to tell me about this speeding up then?
Yeah, I just kind of come across it. It was, again, an article that I picked up through The Guardian and bits and pieces. And it's there's this app that's been developed, and the app developers are now facing abuse from UK drivers, funnily enough. Not quite sure why. But anyway, this app allows anybody to submit evidence of other drivers speeding. And it was an app that uses, and you see it more and more, don't you? You certainly see the use of artificial intelligence creeping into a lot more things now, whether it's through the explosion of the different technologies and that kind of thing. But it's the app estimates the speed of passing cars that you could then use to pass on to the police. But as a consequence of that, the app developers have now gone into hiding because of the response from some drivers. In that sense. And I wasn't quite sure if you'd actually come across it yourself and that you'd seen it and what your thoughts were about it. It was hoped that the police would, through the act, that the police would take speeding more seriously, and that residents, pedestrians and cyclists would be able to document and prove evidence of traffic crimes in their areas. But is it going too far? Do you actually like the idea of being able to turn the normal citizen into local traffic cops? Or do you think policing should be left to the police?
You're being very cheeky here, Dave, because you asked me this question off air, and that is the response I gave to you. you're turning it back against me. For the listener, we had quite a dilemma, is that we started talking off air. Before we knew it, we were doing the podcast, so we had to put a pin in it. But yes, you asked me this question, and I said, I don't, at this moment in time, have a particularly strong response to it, because I've not really read enough about it, cop out answer, but I am not a particularly big fan, generally speaking, of turning the average citizen into law enforcement. I'm not a big fan of co-opting citizens for law enforcement purposes, because the law enforcement are there for a reason, and the citizen shouldn't be put in that position, right? That is a broadly, you know, unrelated answer. That's me as, you know, my opinion. But, you prompted the question. Anyway, I'm not massively a fan of this idea for that reason. I'm not a fan of what it represents from a privacy perspective, because I think it's continuing to extend this arm of the citizen being armed to the teeth with sort of surveillance equipment in the form of their phones, and extending that. We already have mountains of issues with Ring doorbells and domestic CCTV. And I'm not saying this is necessarily an extension of that, but it does feel within that broad vein, right?
I would think, well, it comes to the point which I think you're trying to make is, well, how far is too far? Because you know, I mean, we get the idea, and it's certainly within the article, that there's serious road injuries committed every year. We need to make roads safer, and it's been clear that the quicker you go, especially in speed restricted areas and in unfavorable conditions, the higher the chance of harm. And when you're traveling at speed and you hit somebody, there's going to be, or several people, there's going to be some kind of big injuries and so on out of that. So I get the fact that it's possibly from that point. But if this is acceptable, if it's acceptable for people to take video footage, I mean, it's not suggesting that you're driving a vehicle, but you may well be driving a vehicle, so it may be encouraging you to use your phone whilst you're driving, which is maybe kind of contrary to what current at highway code laws. But where does it stop if you're looking at this? Why do, if that's acceptable, then what isn't acceptable? Is it acceptable then to start doing on the same grounds, if this is preventing speed serious driving offences through excessive speeds and stuff, well, would it not then be permissible to start using facial recognition more over the place for picking up people on the wanted list, for example? Or would it not be worth, you know what I mean? And that kind of stuff. How far is too far? If this is acceptable, where's the limit? You know what I mean? Where's the bar?
I hear what you're saying. And on that facial recognition point, there's something I want to come back to a little later. But yeah, I do hear what you're saying. And ultimately, to bring it back to an actual data protection point, let's see the DPIA. That'd be my take initially. Let's see the DPIA. Let's actually look at the risks associated with it. One of the things I want to talk about a little bit, because we were talking about this off air, and I think it's an interesting topic, is if you're an individual, right, and you record someone speeding, whether it's through an app or on your phone or whatever, if you record someone in that capacity and you then submit that to them saying, oh, look, this Reg here was speeding, or just to take a different example, if you're on the phone with a large company, you record the conversation with the customer service advisor because they're being rude to you. You then submit that to the ombudsman for that particular sector, the regulator. Does that make you, or does that push you as the individual outside the remit of the household or purely personal exemption in the GDPR? What do you think?
Again, I think it's a very good question, and we have discussed this in relation to things like doorbells and the use of drones and things. And I think it's a very good question. If you're if you've got some footage and you're taking it for a purpose that's supplied to the police only, and you're not necessarily disclosing it for commercial gain, or disclosing it to an indefinite number of people. In that sense, and you're not promoting it on the when I said disclosing it to an indefinite number of people, I mean kind of putting it on the website. So if you're on a little website and you're kind of going, these are the top 10 offenders doing speeding through this app or whatever it is, that kind of thing, then you probably are going to be in the remit of a data controller for the information. Whereas if you're kind of going, look, I've taken a picture of something, I'm not happy with it, I'm going to give it to the police. Let's say you took a picture of antisocial behaviour in town or somebody being assaulted and you gave it to the police. I wouldn't necessarily have said that of itself would make you a data controller, because you've got this personal and domestic exemption. Well, this thing's exemption, it's just the GDPR just doesn't apply. The old law, the old 98 Act and the directive behind it, there was an exemption for that, but under the GDPR, it just doesn't apply. So I guess it's a little lesson in semantics, but ultimately I don't think it will be sufficient to make you a controller in that case.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with you. Sorry, if for the listener, if it's particularly loud in here, it's a nice day today, and the entire office has lost their mind because an ice cream van has turned up. So I do apologise if it's a little bit loud. These are the conditions I'm having to work in this week.
The best tip that I could possibly give you, and it's a non-BP related tip, is actually on Teams. If you go onto the three dots at the top where it says more, and then you come down from there to
the noise suppression thing.
Yeah, you can maximize your noise suppression. It's default to kind of just include everything, but you can increase your default sound suppression to it only picks up on your own, only on your voice, and it works.
I've got it on high and hopefully that's working. I obviously can't tell because I'm in the midst of it. Sorry, I muted myself there instinctively. But yes, just a note.
I'm not getting a lot. Yeah, just a.
I'm working in this week. Anyway, moving swiftly on. So that's that speeding app. Broadly, not really in favour of it. I think it's an interesting question as to whether it does, you know, take you outside the remit purely. Of take you outside the remit of just being in the personal or household exemption. I think that's a very valid question, and as you say, we see it a lot in terms of the equipment we're working with. But it makes it very difficult, doesn't it? Ultimately.
And has it necessarily got privacy impact? Well, it may have a privacy impact if you've told somebody not where you are, then suddenly the police are saying, well, we've got an image saying you're here. Is that a privacy impact, and should you necessarily be subject to that unless you've got a proper law enforcement stopping you, as opposed to somebody just naturally snapping you and kind of going, I don't like you, I've taken a picture and sent it to the police?
Yeah, and actually that's an excellent point, Dave, because actually if it's law enforcement, it's caught by part 3 of the Data Protection Act, right? It's caught by the Law Enforcement Directive. And there are a number of provisions there which are specifically targeted at allowing them to undertake their policing activities, which kind of comes back to your first question to me, right? Do you think it's reasonable to co-opt the citizen into law enforcement? And actually, if you're looking purely from a data protection act perspective, it's not, because the citizen isn't caught by the parts of the law enforcement directive that are relevant to this. So actually, that kind of answers your question for you. We got there eventually. I had to think that through, but yeah, I think that's definitely an argument. Do you not think?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. What's interesting for me as well, though, is how it, when you're kind of looking at the use of automated or artificial intelligence to kind of do this kind of thing, and you've got the assessment of the app that must link to stuff. It must be able to must link to something to identify the car. It must link to something to kind of must be some kind of calculation there in order to work out if it's speeding in that sense. So it's pulling information in that the individual wouldn't necessarily have access to. Not readily anyway, in that kind of sense. So I think there's quite a few privacy issues that they'd have to kind of work through and identify prior to actually determine whether the app should be there in the first place, to be fair.
Again, let's just say show us the DPIA, and that'll I'm not going to do the show me the money thing, but yeah, show me the DPIA. I knew that's you were ramping up to. I could tell that's where you were going to go with that.
I was because I was trying to get kind of a very useful segue into the next bit that I've seen, and it's all about DPIAs. Well, predominantly about DPIAs. Have you come across? I don't know when it was. I've just read about it because of the Hungarian Data Protection Authority published their kind of annual whatever it is that they've published, and within there it highlights a fine. That they've the highest fine that they've awarded, and that was for €670,000, and that was on a bank. And what the bank were doing were analysing recorded audio calls of from customer services using artificial intelligence for assessing an individual's emotional state in order to work out who to call back.
Yes.
Okay. So this is what they'll do. And I've seen something similar in the UK, not necessarily from a bank, but I've certainly seen something similar in the UK where people are trying to work out, are people happy, are people not happy? Do they like the service that they're delivering through? Trying to analyse the way, their approach to analysing language, to analysing words and emails and that kind of stuff, to kind of go, somebody's made a complaint, but they're generally happy, are they generally not, because of can we ascertain, can we understand what else is going on here, that kind of thing. And there was a particular bit of software that a service that was, I can't think who it is, I'll have to dig it out if anybody's really interested, but I'm sure a few housing associations went to it in order to kind of do a similar kind of assessment, not necessarily from audio calls, but a similar kind of understanding about people's emotional state and whether they're happy or they're not and that kind of thing. Anyway, the bank said that the purpose was for quality control, complaint prevention, preventing customer migration to other banks, that kind of thing. The privacy notice that they used was only really referring to the processing in general terms. So there wasn't a great deal of information in there, allegedly, from this article I've read, in relation to how the voice analysis and bits and pieces. So it really wasn't being overly transparent at that point. And it only referred to kind of quality control and complaint prevention. So the purpose that they said they're using this for really didn't transit through into fully into the privacy policy. So therefore, have you got any kind of hidden kind of data processing going on? Are we really being transparent? Are we being as clear and unambiguous as we can be? The processing element of it was undertaken under a legitimate interest, which they said was to retain clients when it comes to this customer migration thing. So they were processing under legitimate interest to prevent customer migration, but also to enhance efficiencies within the bank. So again, the legitimate interest doesn't necessarily stack up to the purposes of the processing when you're looking at everything that was involved in that sense. The bank also failed to give proper notice to the individuals. As we looked, the privacy notices there wasn't really transparent, but they also failed to provide the individuals with a right to object to that type of processing. So therefore, we're restricting an individual's rights, that kind of thing. The output of all this is the fact that there was actually a DPIA undertaken, and this is why I was kind of moving towards on the last discussion about DPIAs, because of the link. And now this had a DPIA, and when you said on the previous conversation, let's have a look at the DPIA. Well, we had a DPIA available in this situation. But the DPIA, according to the Hungarian Data Protection Authority, really failed to present substantial solutions to the risks that were identified. In that sense.
Yes, so they've really, really not followed it through. And actually,
the legitimate interest failed to take into account. Yeah, the legitimate interest assessment failed to take into account proportionality. It failed to take into account the interests of the data subjects, and it's only my terms, this certainly wasn't part of the assessment and part of the article that I've read, but it would appear, and this is where a question's coming, whether you've seen something similar, it would appear that the essence of the DPIA and the essence of the legitimate interest assessment and the essence of possibly the privacy notice and things were heavily skewed to the favour of the organisation, not necessarily to being an objective assessment of risk.
Yeah, and that's actually a good point, because I do see a lot of that. I review a whole host of DPIs and LIAs, and there is a tendency to say, oh, we need to do this for, our fundraising activity. You know, we need to do this as an organization. You know, it's valuable to us. We need to do it. And all too often it's, oh, yeah, it'll probably also impact the people that, you know, whose data we're using. But, you know, they should expect it. It's fine. Don't worry about it. You do still see a lot of it. You do still see a lot of it. And fundamentally, that's a misunderstanding of what the tools are, whether it's an LIA or a DPIA. That is quite a significant misunderstanding. I'm not a fan of that entire type of tech. I think it's a little bit too aggressive in terms of what it does. I don't want to get into it, and I don't know if any listeners have shared in this experience with me, but I've just recently started reading, I don't know if you've heard about this, Dave, it's a book called, it's a book on the age of surveillance capitalism by a lady called, I think her name is Shoshana Zuboff, something like that. It's on my Kindle. But anyway, that talks a lot about basically weaponizing a huge amount of the human experience for ultimately profit, and this is kind of the sort of thing that it's getting at, right? Is you can't even have a phone call anymore without a piece of AI analyzing whether you are in a receptive mood and therefore should be called back or not. And it's just the encroachment now, I think, with a lot of this tech into our everyday lives is becoming it's slightly ridiculous to say that this is my breaking point. I don't think it is. Let me be clear. But this is again another step where you go, really? Like, do we need this? Is this?
It comes to me on the fact that how far is too far, and just because you can doesn't mean you should.
That's a concept. Point. Yeah.
Because it's. I can certainly. I'm not necessarily saying I agree with it, but I can certainly see the argument. Let's take it away from this. Let's say it's a sales thing and people are phoning up trying to sell sales. And through analysing that, if you could analyse that and say, well, actually, this from the analysis, we can determine that if you fit this bracket or you fit this kind of alert, you're more susceptible to buy and therefore to keep going with the sales process. Whereas if from analysis, it shows that the guy's really recipient so disinterested, you're not going to get anywhere. Then there's going to be efficiencies in that from killing the call and talking to somebody else. There's going to be efficiencies in the fact that actually you're going to get some money out of this. We might as well progress with the call. So I can certainly see when you look at data and understanding how you can analyze the data and get the value of data, I can certainly see why AI might be used and how it could be used and that kind of stuff. But it doesn't necessarily mean it should be. You know what I mean? In that sense, although I can understand where the concept's going, I don't necessarily agree with it from a privacy point, because why should you be in your normal private life be subject to that kind of, like you say, intrusive and quite hard-lined approach to, can I monetize this? Can I make more money out of it? Can I address customer services? And let's be fair, most of it's to address something. So it's all right saying we're doing this in order to prevent, like with the bank's case, we're trying to prevent customer migration. Well, that's a money thing because it means the customer retains or the bank retains the customer. If we can do it where we can kind of look at sales tactics and bits and pieces, that will help with sales or it'll help with efficiencies and that all has monetary values and bits and pieces. So I just don't think in everyday life you should be subject to that kind of intrusive behaviour in that sense.
No, agreed. And there's a broader point to be made here. And I think you kind of touched on it there, which is an excellent point, which is that you're talking about the private citizen, right, and everyday life. It's not the same argument as talking about using this for law enforcement, which, to be clear, I'm not condoning by saying this necessarily, but you could more understand the use of facial recognition for law enforcement purposes, right, than for just purely marketing, because you get into the area where it's excessive. I'm aware of the time, Dave, and I'm aware that Miles needs to edit this and put it out before we clock off for the weekend, and we're quickly running out of time. But that is a conversation I would like to re-explore at a future point, so we'll make a note of that. I think the last thing, and I didn't really want to finish on this because it's a little bit dicey, but I think we probably have to mention it, was the story this week, and I think you will have seen it as well, and it's annoying because I can't find it off the top of my head, but this story about someone basically leaking information in relation to I'm trying to think of the what's the politically correct way of saying this, like a child predator, maybe
a
paedophile, you can say that, and basically leaking information in relation to them, and basically getting away with it, as far as I'm aware, right? That nothing has really come to this person who's leaked this information, as far as I can tell. And yeah, I think, as I say, not the jolliest topic to end on, but we have to address it because it's a very important story for a number of reasons, right? I don't know if you actually came across it.
I haven't. I've seen the headline, but I didn't actually read it. So how did the individual come across the information in the first place?
So, and I'm just trying to jog my memory, if you'll bear with me, but it's effectively someone who worked for a local council, and I believe had access to the information, should have had access to the information as part of their role, I think. I don't know that for certain, but I believe so anyway, and basically took it upon themselves to leak that information to a paedophile hunting group, right? It's one of these vigilante groups, and yeah, leaked the information to them, and as a result, this is all whipped up a frenzy. Now, the first thing to say, ultimately, I think there are two things that we have to point out in relation to this. First of all, that type of behaviour is an offence under the Computer Misuse Act, right? That's and that can carry a custodial sentence. So the fine of £500 that this person has incurred is getting away with it, you know, fundamentally, considering the scale of the enforcement that could have come from that. And the other part is that while we all have very strong emotional reactions to this type of offender in particular, offender management is an incredibly important part of our governments, our social services, our law enforcement services, and
judicial system,
and people who take it upon themselves to do this sort of thing are really, really hindering the work that a lot of people put into what is an incredibly important part of our systems, right? And it's incredibly frustrating, I'm sure, for people involved in offender management to have I don't even want to refer to them as vigilantes because that's too glorified, but someone taking it upon themselves to do this sort of thing. It's childish, quite frankly, to do this sort of thing. It's not your role or position to do that.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with everything you said. It's a really sensitive and quite emotive situation, but taking out the fact that let's put that in a different situation. Let's say it was something less emotive, so taking it away from the case that it was somebody took information from the system that identified a group of, let's say, young adults causing antisocial behavior issues within society, and then fed that to a local group of community individuals that said, I'm fed up with antisocial behaviour in the town. My wife can't walk downtown without getting harassed. My kids can't play in the park without being faced with drugs or Catalan drugs and stuff. So then we've got a group of men on an evening that, armed with this information, will go and make the problem go away. You know what I mean? It's very similar to that kind of situation, isn't it? And is that necessarily right in that case? And if that was in that case, and the example I've just provided there, would that individual necessarily have been found are penalised to a greater extent, either under the Computer Misuse Act or, as you know, under Section 170 of the DPA, where you've got an offence for unlawfully obtaining personal data knowingly or recklessly without the consent of the controller. So, you know what I mean? So you've got a couple of offences there that could be used. I'm just trying to take the emotion out of it slightly from what you've just from the actual facts in order to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just so that we've got the facts straight here, because I've just read up while you were making that point. The essence of it is that the convicted, so that's the first point to establish. This is a convicted child molester, this convicted paedophile, right? There's no issues around that. Move to a secret address, right, to protect their integrity, to protect them, basically, because that's the sort of thing you have to do, right? Regardless of all of our emotional reactions to that type of act, you know, there are processes to follow. And apparently that individual had then been in touch with the council to reach out for a food parcel. And as part of that, this customer service advisor took it upon themselves to leak their information to a Facebook group. And, you know, they've come up with a list of justification for it, saying that it's a public service, which is frankly, yeah, less said about that, the better. Also saying that they themselves were in a destabilized state for family reasons when they took it upon themselves to do this. But I think you're right. I think you have to take the emotion out of it, right? First of all, because that's important. And secondly, you have to look at it objectively, what it is, which is interfering with, you know, established processes in the judicial and penal system in a way which you're not entitled to do. You know, and I think the problem is that then people do get emotional about it, as you say. Emotional is not really the right term, but you know what I'm getting at. People get very caught up in the heat of it all.
So it's an emotive topic, yeah.
It's an emotive topic, exactly, and are more likely to condone this type of behaviour, which, let's be honest, if you did this in a different context, if you decide to take it upon yourself to, you know, interfere in the judicial or penal system in this way when you have absolutely no right to do so, you know, people would be very upset by that, I'm sure.
For sure.
And the only reason that it's being put across as justifiable in this context is because of the nature of the crime in question.
And that's the reason that's the reason why I tried to just set it aside slightly with a slightly different kind of a play on the same thing, and take the emotion out of it, make it less emotive, and that kind of thing. So using the example I said about an individual's fed up with ASB, so they basically took the information in a similar circumstances, sent it to a local, in essence, vigilante group for them to take action to stop the local park being used for drugs, antisocial behaviour, families, friends, dogs, kids can go and use a park in that kind of stuff. But if that was the case, there'd be an outcry saying, what, the kids are entitled to freedom of space, the kids just being kids, it's what most young adults do, there'd be greater justification for it, they're entitled to privacy and that kind of stuff. You've got a lot of young adults out there, 18 upwards, 16 upwards, that might be quite angry with the world because of what's going on. It's all part of growing up, and you get all this kind of justification going about it, and then there'll be all the elements of, well, aren't they entitled to privacy, they're only kids, that kind of stuff. Now, I'm not trying to bring it back, but taking the emotive out of it, if you're entitled to privacy, at what point in the law did it say if you commit this type of offence, you lose all rights to privacy?
That's a very good point. That's a very good point, because then you're talking about effectively bordering on what are constitutional rights, aren't they? I mean, ultimately, yeah. And you can make the argument, I mean, it's not the same, don't get me wrong, but I'm drawing a very clumsy and very lazy parallel with almost like the right to vote. At what point are you stripped of a right to vote as an individual based on your actions? And it's kind of the same thing.
So you look at the US and you commit certain crimes in the US, yeah, and you lose the right to bear arms, you lose the right to vote and for a period or indefinitely, depending on the nature of the offence, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So where in UK law does it say you're not entitled to privacy dependent on the offence that you've committed?
And it's exactly the same thing as what we were discussing, and it creates a nice loop, actually, even though it's not a pleasant topic. It's a nice loop to conclude on. We were talking about the start of the show. We're talking about at what point, when you are either a celebrity or an office or in the public eye, does it say, well, not does it say, because it's not, there's no law associated with it, but at what point do you lose your entitlement to privacy, right?
For
and
sure.
It goes both ways, ultimately.
And just to be absolutely clear, and I'm sure I don't necessarily need to say this, but we'll just say it, to be absolutely clear, I am not condoning the behaviour. I'm just looking at it objectively,
yeah.
in light of what the... In light of what the law says, and in light with the fact you've got an entitlement to privacy, as far as I'm aware, there's no offence in the UK that says if you do this, you lose your entitlement to privacy and people are in free to hound you as much as they like, that kind of thing.
I think it goes without saying that we're not condoning any type of behaviour here. We're simply trying to look at it analytically and trying to work with it. But what we can condemn is a number of the acts that we've talked about in here, certainly. And in this instance, we're talking specifically about someone, as I say, interfering in a way which they weren't entitled to in an established system. And we can condemn that without necessarily condoning anything untoward, any of the acts that have brought about that type of behaviour. So anyway, before we get into a deeper quagmire than we're already in, I suggest we bring this to a close. But some very interesting topics. I think it was worthwhile doing this session, Dave. Any final thoughts for this week before we leave the listeners and we join them again for the ISO 27001 event next week?
No, my only final thoughts is I've quite enjoyed the discussion today. It's been slightly different on a different day. That kind of thing is less restricted with the hour that we normally give it. So we're just slightly over the clock. So I do hope you appreciate it. But the only leaving parting comments from me is to have a good Easter. And we look forward to meeting you for the next one.
Yeah, to be fair, I don't think we are actually over the clock because we started this meeting sort of 15 minutes before we started recording. So I think we've technically still got another 10 minutes. But I am aware that poor producer Miles has got to edit this and put it up before he goes on his weekend. So I'm conscious of that and I do need to wrap up. And I've also got things to do before I finish. So without further ado, let's leave it there. So thank you very much, Dave, for taking the time to speak to us this afternoon. I very much enjoyed that. Some tricky topics, don't get me wrong, but important to discuss as ever, and important to take a reasonable, balanced and as analytical as possible approach to things, I think. So thank you very much for your time. As you say, we're wishing the listeners a very happy Easter. And generally, if you are getting time off, even if you're not the type to celebrate Easter or it doesn't come into your particular circles, then we still hope you have a very nice break over this time. I'm certainly looking forward to it. And we hope you'll join us for the ISO 27001 event. We've been talking about that a lot. We are really looking forward to it. God, it's going to disappoint at this rate if we keep hyping it up. But if you haven't yet secured an invite to that, head to the DPP website, the events page up there. You can sign up or reach out to any of us on our socials. Failing that, info@dataprotectionpeople.com is the email address. And again, before I leave you, if you wouldn't mind leaving us a review either on the podcast streaming service that you are listening to this on. That's a terribly convoluted sentence. When you'd like to leave us a review on the particular streaming service that you're listening to us on right now, or head to Trustpilot, leave us a review there, drop mine and Dave's name in that review. It would be greatly appreciated. Without further ado, I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to leave you to enjoy your weekend, listener, and we'll catch up with you very soon.
Thank you. Take care.
Cheers. Cool. That'll do. Nice one, Dave. Thanks for that.